that's not required to call into the show, that is a separate thing entirely. We have a separate number, 244-9455 for that. And May actually has been very generous. She brought in a couple of things as a way to encourage people to make a pledge. We have two copies of her book, Buzzwords, and we have some T-shirts, kids T-shirts, and these are our film festival T-shirts from the Insect Fear Film Festival.
Yes, these are limited edition, sort of, I guess, three of a kind. Once they're gone, they're gone. In fact, I thought they were already gone. These are from the 1998 15th Insect Fear Film Festival. Aficionados know we are approaching our 24th festival. So this was 1998, Cockroaches. And they are actually the only professionally designed T-shirts in the whole run of the festival that we've ever had. Mm. And they feature cockroaches. That was our all-cockroach program back in 98. And there are certainly a lot of cockroaches on these T-shirts.
It looks like it's just covered with cockroaches. So if you have a child that you know would love to have a T-shirt covered with cockroaches, we have three, and only three, ladies and gentlemen. And what size are these?
These are medium, that says size 10 to 12, Hanes Beefy Tees, 100% pre-shrunk cotton.
So you're getting a quality T-shirt in the bargain, ladies and gentlemen. All right, so what we're asking is if you will call in and you will make a pledge at the $40 level or above, that's the basic level or above, you could have a copy of the book, Buzzwords, and we have two, and May is going to
personally inscribe it however you'd like. I mean, I could write my name, or I could write your name, or I could write a name of your favorite insect, or I could write whatever you like in
all
there.
Right. She'll write, as long as the FCC will approve, she'll write whatever you want.
Right.
And then we also have the three kids T-shirts. So $40 or better, give us a call, 244-9455, and please make sure you tell the volunteer which of these things you want so we can make sure that we get them to you. And we'll do that. Okay. Well, glad to have you here.
Always a pleasure.
We have a caller already to go in Charleston. We will talk with them on our line four, toll-free line. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Last week in Indianapolis, I saw this big turquoise bug. I've never seen a turquoise bug before. What could it have been?
Was it sort of beetle-like, or did it have big wings like a butterfly? Or
No. It was more beetle-like.
So shiny turquoise. Or not shiny.
It's got little spots on it. It has a big long antenna, the head, the thorax, and then the big abdomen. It's a beetle-like. And it was working its way around a log that was lying partially in water.
Very interesting. So odds are good. Sort of shiny turquoise.
Turquoise.
Yeah.
I mean, this thing just stood out like a sore thumb.
Was it sort of like not exactly cylindrical, but kind of not flattened, right? It was.
No, it's not flattened.
Because that kind of sounds like one of the Buprestid beetles. Buprestids have a common name of boring beetles. It's not because they're boring. They're actually quite fascinating.
They bore into wood.
And they bore. That's why they call them boring beetles. And their hallmark is that they are incredibly brightly colored. I mean, very metallic, shiny.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, they're so brightly colored and metallic that they have been used for jewelry and for clothing, and there's actually a shrine in Japan that's decorated with the wings of Buprestid beetles. So there are a number of species. I am just now cheating here and looking to see if I can find a Buprestid that is bright turquoise, because there's a bright emerald green Buprestid, which is causing all kinds of problems, called the emerald ash borer, but it wouldn't be.
I wouldn't call this one emerald. Yeah. It was turquoise.
There's a golden Buprestid.
I'm looking at my picture of it.
Well, actually, if you want, if you have a digital image, just...
Oh, yeah, it's digital.
Yeah, just send me an email, and I can probably get you a better name than just maybe a Buprestid. So you can just email me at the university, and I'll see if I can get a name. That would be my guess, because it was big and obvious. It was.
Yeah, I would estimate it was probably about 3/4 to an inch long.
Yeah, the Prestids are big, and yeah. I mean, it may not seem big, but in the insect world, that's pretty big.
Yeah, and it was like, oh, good grief, what do I have here? because I could hardly believe it.
And this was Indianapolis, right?
It was in Indianapolis. I was actually in, oh dear, what's the name of that park? On the northwest side, Eagle Creek Park. No, I wasn't.
Oh, okay.
I was north of Indianapolis. I was at Carmel and a park there.
So that's really our general neighborhood, central Indiana. Then.
Yeah. And just, you know, walking along this trail trying to get around this yucky, muddy spot on the trail without falling in.
Do you know if there are any birch trees in the neighborhood?
You know, I did. Trees are, by and large, for me, things birds sit in.
Oh. Well, because if it was a wet area...
It was very wet.
There are alders and poplars tend to grow in wet areas, and there is a very famous birch borer, Duprested, called the bronze birch borer. I'm not sure it's turquoise, but it's...
This one's turquoise.
It kind of fits the description.
Yeah. So
that might have been what you had, but it certainly sounds like a Duprested.
Okay.
Very cool.
Hey, yeah, it was. All right, thank you.
Thank you.
All right, well, thank you for the call. And I think that we have someone else here in Belgium over by Danville on number one. Hello.
Good morning.
Mm-hmm. Hello.
Ms. Mayor Barenbaum, I was hoping that you might reinforce a childhood memory for me.
Oh, cool.
When I was about 8 to 10 years old, I lived in Panama in the Canal Zone. And as I'm sure you know, it's a rainforest, and it's a jungle that comes down to about the house. Well, one day we walk out on the veranda, and we look down, and I see for what looks all the world like a grasshopper. However, this grasshopper is as big around as a garden hose.
Ah.
And he is probably a good 6 inches long, or she. I'm not sure which sex it was. We put it in a quart jar, and it could not turn around in a quart jar. So it was a very, very large grasshopper. Now, am I imagining this, or is there such a grasshopper?
Well, there are large grasshoppers. I'm not completely familiar with Central American insect fauna, but things tend to get larger near the tropics. I know the most famous of all grasshoppers, probably, the Schistocerca gregaria, which is the desert locust of biblical fame, is easily 3 to 4 inches long. So it isn't that exceptional. I mean, give an inch or two for childhood, disproportion. Everything looked bigger to a kid.
Sure.
So it wouldn't be out of the realm of possibility. Katydids also can be pretty big. They're tropical katydids that I would say would be maybe as big as a child's hand, except katydids have a very different shape. They're sort of leaf shape. But this was definitely grasshopper shape.
Grasshopper-type legs and long body and looked a whole lot like a grasshopper.
Yeah. Well,
I picked it up.
I know that Schistocerca gregaria is, a hefty 3 inches at least and maybe four. So it wouldn't be beyond the realm of possibility. Things tend to, among the biggest insects in the world are from tropical regions, like the Hercules beetle, the Scarabaean beetles that are over 6 inches long and weigh more than a mouse. And they're, you can find those and their relatives in that part of the world. So why not large-sized grasshoppers?
Why not a big grasshopper? Thank you very much.
Well, not as big, of course, as the grasshoppers that destroyed Ludlow in Beginning of the End.
Right. They were big grasshoppers. Oh,
That's a special category. That's a grasshopper.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And on we go. We have other opportunity for other questions. 333-9455 here in Champaign-Urbana. Toll free, 800-222-9455. If you'd like to talk with our guest, May Barenbaum. She's head of the Department of Entomology at University of Illinois. And here is someone else, Robinson, line four. Hello.
Good morning, David and May.
Hello.
I was in the garden this morning and saw a most peculiar insect on a rose leaf, and I hoped you could identify him. He was tiny, black, perhaps 3/8 of an inch long, and had the most peculiar wings. Envision an airplane whose wings are parallel with the ground. This bug was the opposite configuration. his two wings were vertical, like as he paddled through the air like a steamboat. And he had a very sharp pointed proboscis, as if he were a borer or something like that, that had to pierce a leaf. Have any idea what he might be?
Is it was a black, did you say?
Yes.
Okay, well, what comes to mind, this is a guess here, there's a kind of fly called an otitid. It's kind of related to a true fruit finger fly, a picture wing fly. And they have not piercing mouth parts, but they do have mouth parts that project forward. If they really were true sucking mouth parts, that would make it a true bug. But there aren't many that have wings that are held up above. So, like, kind of like a butterfly holds its wings sort of upright and not parallel. Is that how you describe it?
No, they were parallel but vertical.
Right. Like a moth or a butterfly, how it holds its wings at rest or no?
No, it's as if they were attached to the side of the insect's body.
Yeah.
But were permanently fixed up in a vertical plane.
Oh, okay. I still think it might be an otitid.
Would you spell that for me?
Sure. Those are, it would be, the family name is O-T-I-T-I-D-A-E. And they're related to the tephritids, the true fruit flies.
Yeah.
And they do have this peculiar way of moving their wings around that doesn't look like they could get off the ground, actually. Did it kind of look like it was defying the laws of gravity by moving its... Did it flap really quickly or just really kind of slowly?
Well, he was at rest on the rose leaf. I did not actually observe him fly, but his wings were in this strange vertical position, much like the fin on an airplane. You know what I'm in the vertical.
Mm-hmm. Well, there are a lot of not a lot. I mean, there are some moths that hold their wings that way, and
but this was not a moth.
No, definitely not a moth. But I would guess that, and there are a number of flies that do. And black is kind of typical of this group of flies, the tephritids. There's some black and white tephritids. There's otitids, and then I know these names are hardly euphonious here. Pergotids, and some of them have mouth parts that kind of look like they project forward.
Uh-huh.
And I'm guessing this because I've seen the wings on some of these otitids, and they look odd, like they've been kind of put on, like someone's making a airplane model and didn't glue them on correctly, kind of thing. So,
yeah, right.
I don't know if that's the way it looked, but that's the way they look to me. So.
Well, thank you for your help. Mm-hmm. If possible, I will capture one and study it more closely.
Or even a digital image. These days, it's incredibly convenient. You can just email a digital image, and we'll try to get a name for you.
I have neither a computer nor a camera.
Oh, well, then there's nothing that beats good old-fashioned eyesight. So.
Okay.
All right. Thanks.
Thank you, Mac.
Thank you very
much. You realize now the rest of us sitting here talking, listening to you talk about the otitids and the ophridids and the whatever. we have no idea if you're making this up or not.
You can see right here on my cheat sheet.
Okay, she has a textbook, so yeah, no doubt she's not.
You just add enough syllables and people will believe it's a scientific term.
Well, so. Unless you can't do that in an entomologist convention, but for the rest of us... Yeah, we're going to say, oh, yeah, otitids. Oh, yeah, okay, I know all about those. We have several callers here, again, with questions for our guest, May Barenbaum, 333-9455. Toll free, 800-222-9455. There's caller on line number one. Hello. The caller on line one. I'm not sure where you're calling from, line one.
Is it me?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Oh, hi. Yeah, I have two very strange insects I've seen. One is a black spider with the body's about maybe half to three-quarter inch diameter, and it's got this bright white, distinctly drawn, looks like a shuttle, just right there on its back.
Like a saddle?
Like a shuttle, like a space shuttle.
Oh, a shuttle.
That. Just this white, distinctly drawn shape. And the other is this huge, huge ant that's about an inch and a quarter. It looks exactly like an ant, but it's fire engine red, and it's velvety. And I haven't been able to catch one or get a picture.
I think you don't want to catch those.
Yes, that's. I think David's been on this show long enough to know, recognize a velvet ant when he hears one.
Yeah, indeed. And they're not ants.
What are they?
They're wasps.
You want to take this one, Dave?
They're wasps. They're wingless wasps. And I think if you grabbed one, it would be real unhappy about it, and then you'd be real unhappy about it.
Yeah, they have a very potent sting.
Okay.
And they're called velvet ants, even. And as David says, they are truly, they're not, they're wingless wasps.
Oh.
And
They were scary looking.
They do pack a punch. So, yeah, generally, things are red, you should stay away from them.
Yeah. So, what about that spider?
Well, that's I'm not by any means a spider expert. Typically, I know there are some black spiders, local spiders with white markings, but they're much smaller, and they're called jumping spiders. This one didn't jump, right?
Yeah, no, I know the jumping spiders. Yeah. This is different. I've never seen one like this before or since.
So there is a. I brought my butterflies of Illinois and my hawk moths of Illinois giant silkworm moths of Illinois, but I did not bring my spiders of Illinois. So
okay.
Again, my guess is it's probably one of the orb weavers. They tend to be conspicuously marked. The golden orb weaver is about that size range, but it's marked with not just white and black, but also gold. You know, sort of a yellowish. But that sounds not quite right either. So,
I had a quick question about a butterfly. Then, if I could ask,
butterflies are good, better than spiders. Yes, thank you.
It was a yellow swallowtail.
Oh, my
and it was
favorites.
In my yard the other day,
uh-huh.
And I was taking pictures of it, and then it flew off over the roof of my house. Now, is it migrating or will it come back? That's what I'm wondering. And what can I do something to attract
it? The swallowtails don't migrate. I mean, there are migratory butterflies, notably the monarchs, and then painted ladies will migrate too. But swallowtails tend to be residents. And if it was a big, truly yellow swallowtail with black stripes, that's a tiger swallowtail, aptly named Eastern Tiger Papilio glaucus. And they are residents of this area. And they, if this time of year, it may very well have been a female looking to lay her eggs. And they prefer trees. I don't know if you have any cherry trees in the yard or tulip poplar or.
I have one small cherry tree, but it hasn't given cherries yet.
Oh well, they don't care about the cherries; they like the leaves. So
okay.
So you probably have in your yard all you need to attract a female.
Uh-huh.
And if it's a male, then what you need to attract to keep it in the yard is females. So.
Okay.
So, butterflies do, by the way, like to nectar on the plant that's called butterfly bush. They also like milkweeds, and swallowtails tend to like sort of pink and purplish flowers.
So. Oh, it was purple flowers that was flying around.
There you go.
Yeah.
Was it lilacs by any chance?
No, it's these wildflowers that come up and they grow to about 3 feet tall, and they look like lilacs, only it's just one plant. You know,
out
of the ground.
That's the typical, that's their favorite kind of color and kind of flower. So,
great.
So you're all set. You should see more of them.
Okay,
sure.
Thanks.
Thank
all
you.
Right. Well, thank you for the call. We have some other folks here, and we'd be very happy to talk with them in a moment. As soon as we take a little time to remind you just how important your support of this radio station is. This will be the last time here this week here on Focus 580. We'll have the chance to ask you to support the station. We're raising the money that will pay for next year's programming. This is our spring fund drive, and we're coming down to the end. It is your last, one of your last opportunities to show your appreciation for Focus and the other shows that you listen to on this station. Our telephone number, if you'd like to call to make a pledge, 244-9455.
This is Hank Spees. I've been a guest regularly on Focus 580 for at least 25 years now, and I consider it an extension of the university's public service. And I've gotten many comments over the years as to how effective and how widespread the University Public Service provided by WILL spreads throughout the state. I think it is a very valuable contribution that the stations are making, and I will continue to work with them as long as I can.
We hope that if you appreciate this kind of show, the shows, for example, like those that Hank does, and that other people who have expertise in a particular field, they come in here and we give you the chance to ask questions about whatever that particular thing is. And I know that these are some of the most popular things we do. If you ask what are the shows that get the most calls, there are programs like that, where we have some sort of expert and the idea is quick, direct, fairly specific questions. We do a lot of those shows, and we also do other kinds of programs that we hope that will get you thinking about things or maybe introduce you to some subject that you had not heard of before. And, of course, we do that without commercials, but we can do that because listeners support the stations with their dollars. That's really important. Now is the time you can make a call, and May was good enough to bring with her some things to use to encourage you to call. Standing by in Pledge Central is Les Schulte. He's our corporate support director. Have we gotten some takers, Les, on the books?
We have a call coming in right now, and I'm sure May didn't bring these books along to take them back, so let's get these books out of here. It's called Buzzwords. This is May's book, and she'll sign it for you or write something in. And that's very generous of her. Thank you very much. And we also have three T-shirts from the 1998 Insect Film Fear Film Festival. Did I say that right?
Yes.
Okay, great.
Yes.
Okay.
Insect Fear Film Festival.
Fear Film Festival.
You're an announcer guy. You should be able to get that.
That's right. That's right, David. I am. They're a size medium. And so then the next three callers, you'll get the T-shirt. And these are just a couple of incentives that May has brought along to encourage you to support Focus 580. And we're not down to the wire. We're at the wire right now for Focus 580. And the number to call is 217-244-9455. This is a unique program, and it's listener-supported. And the audience for public radio, as we know, has been growing over the years. And what that means is that there's more opportunity now for more people to shape the future of this radio station with your call at 217-244-9455 when you make that basic membership pledge of $40 or maybe up that to $75. You'll get a WILL member card, two-for-one dining at literally hundreds of restaurants throughout the state of Illinois. This is the final day for Focus for our spring pledge period as we're closing that gap towards our $900,000 membership goal. This is the money we're going to need to operate this station next year from member support that we estimate. And that's going to account for probably 40 or a little over 40% of the budget next year. So you can see how your dollars are going to really shape the future of the programs and services we'll be able to bring you next year. If this is having a local talk show that brings experts like May onto the program and Hank and national figures onto the program so that you can call and talk to them directly is important to you. Having this kind of a service is important in our community. Call 217-244-9455 right now. We want these books leave the building here, as May will sign them for you, her book, Buzzwords. I know it has sex in the title, too, doesn't it, May?
Yeah. Yeah, so sex, bugs, and rock and roll.
Rock and roll, boy, yeah. How could you not read a book like that? Also, one gone, okay. Then we also have the T-shirts.
And these are, now, friends, what child would not like a shirt covered with cockroaches?
Oh.
And as she said, this is a collector's item. This is from one of the past festivals, and she just happened to, in a drawer somewhere, she found three of these shirts. And as she said, when they're gone, they're gone.
Hey, David, can I ask May a question?
Yeah.
Sure. Would you want a donation at your lab? May have maybe about a couple of thousand ants that I have in my home right now.
It's very kind of you to offer, but we're okay.
Are you all right on that? All right. Well, I've actually heard my cat say, "Put that food down," as they are going across. I don't know what the deal is this year, but I have a lot of ants, and I'd be happy to share them with anyone. Maybe I could offer that at a pledge level, too.
I don't think so.
Okay.
Yeah, I don't think so.
Phones are ringing. Let's keep them ringing right now at 217-244-9455 in support of Focus 580.
All right. Thank you very much, Les. We will check with you again at the end of the program, and we really would like to hear from as many people as possible because this is the money that will pay for next year's programs, and we have a ways to go if we're going to meet our fundraising goal before the end of the year. So that's the deal. 244-9455 is the number. Give us a call. Make a pledge. You can also go online, by the way, willpledge.org, and make your pledge that way. Our guest in this part of Focus 580 is May Barenbaum. She's professor and head of the Department of Entomology at the U of I. She is a scientist who specializes in studying insects. And let us remember, ladies and gentlemen, spiders are not insects. She thinks the things with six legs, pretty much. That's what she does. And if you have a question about an insect that you have seen, you can give us a call. Also, you can go down to the bookstore and look for some of her books. She has written a number of them, Buzzwords being one, but there are several. And if you're curious about insects, you like reading about them, you might take a look at her books like 99 Gnats, Nits, Nibblers, and 99 More Mites,
Maggots, Mites, and Munchers.
Maggots, Mites, Munchers, stuff that starts with M. And was there ever, there was going to be a third one, wasn't there? Kind of like
another, what is it? Another 99 Aphids, Antlions, and Annoyances, I think, is the working title.
So. Okay. So that's yet to come?
Yet to come. I got distracted. So.
She probably has to do some more important, like serious scientific papers and stuff. So her books are there in the bookstore. And we are here and would be happy to talk with people who are listening. So with all that said, let's go to Indiana and line number two. Hello.
Hello. Three things. One, you mentioned some books you brought with you, Insects of Illinois and I think Butterflies. Are those published by the University of Illinois, or are they pamphlets from the Extension Office or whatever?
They're actually wonderful books from the Illinois Natural History Survey.
Oh.
And they're written by, they're field guides written by John Bousman and Jim Sternberg.
How do you spell that first fellow's last name?
Bousman, B-O-U-S-E. M-A-N, and I'm sad to say he just died about a week ago, and I'm happy at least to remember him here. He and Jim Sternberg, Sternberg is an emeritus professor in our department and an absolutely phenomenal photographer. So these are just sumptuously illustrated. They're gorgeous animals to start with. And so the two books that are out already are Field Guide to the Butterflies of Illinois and to the Silk Moths of Illinois. There's also, I'm not sure it's out yet, but they did the Skippers, the Hesperians.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh, that'd be nice.
Yeah. So I recommend them highly. And the nice thing about these books is they tell you about the distribution within the state.
Yeah.
And, you know, they have sort of an evaluation of whether or not county reports are reliable and about what the local host plant use is. So it's really, it's much, much more useful than sort of Peterson's field guide to the Eastern, you know, bugs of Eastern North America, because there's a lot of things that are in Eastern North America that may not be in Illinois. So
yeah.
I recommend them highly.
Okay, now that's the Illinois.
It's called Field Guide to either Butterflies of Illinois or Silk Moths of Illinois.
Okay, the publisher's what I was at.
Oh, I'm sorry, Illinois Natural History Survey.
That's what I wrote down quickly, and I didn't realize it was history. Illinois Natural History Survey.
Yeah.
They on the web, I imagine?
Yeah, they certainly would be on
okay.
the web.
Okay.
Yeah, they're located right here in Champaign-Urbana along with the university.
Okay. Second thing, which I'd asked something about before, but I didn't have a better description. I'm going to, for some reason, it rings in my mind, it may be a katydid egg mass, but anyway, it's call it brown. It's frothy. It's maybe 2 inches in its largest length, and it's maybe inch and a half in thickness, and it's on a just a regular, you know, grapevine or something like that. And I've been watching it, and nothing's happened yet. Nothing's eaten its way out of it or anything. And I was just wondering if you have any idea of whether it's really an egg mass I'm dealing with.
I would guess that it's a mantis egg mass.
Oh, really?
Good.
Yeah. Good. Yeah.
Katydids tend to lay their eggs into loose bark or, you know, on
good.
Plant material within,
I'll pick up my little schedule on it.
Yeah.
I used to raise, well, not raise them. I had some, or they had me, however you want to look at it. Okay, the next question I'd asked in the past, but this time there's more information. I got my favorite place, and the sunlight was shining, and had those nice little pathways coming down, and all of a sudden those little critters showed up, and there's little balls moving around. And these seem to come and go. They would be there, and I'd be watching, and all of a sudden they'd just sort of like get larger, you know, and make the mass much larger, and sort of like the shape, the ball shape, sort of lose its definitiveness, then they would come back together. And I was trying to find out whether they were different groups or going from one place to the other or anything. But it was rather phenomenal. I watched it for about 15 minutes it went on, and I'd never seen that before. And I think I told you in the past I had run through those things, which is not a smart thing to do. But as a kid, you know, it was right at that height. And so I've been watching them, and I've never seen this kind of behavior happen, you know, before with them. But, you know, maybe just I hadn't seen enough of them actually doing those things. So I wonder if you could give a quickie about some of that.
So it's kind of like a mass or aggregation?
Yeah, you know, it's an aggregate, and they sort of move. And I think you told me, I couldn't remember whether it's the male that goes into the mass, and I presume that's not true, and that it's really a bunch of males waiting for a female to come into the mass and pick a mate.
That's exactly what it sounds like is one of the sort of mating aggregations for the chironomids or the midges. And they just sort of hang suspended in this sort of large smoky mass and that sort of kind of moves in and out like you describe. And it's well known that they'll identify a particular place, you know.
Oh, yeah.
But nobody knows exactly what the markers are, how they know. There's no sign that says, singles bar or whatever.
Yeah.
And that it is a mass of males, and they're the females will fly into a mass to find a mate. And and it is sort of eerie, at least in part to me, because it's so quiet, you know.
Yeah,
there's
right. You know, I just sit in. I have a garage I can sit in, and I got a thing, and I have like a tunnel lookout, so I have a very well framed thing that's quite luminescent. And when anything shows up like that, I can, besides those the midgets and stuff like that. But I was just wondering, is there pheromones in place? Does anybody know? I mean, I don't know how the hell you do experiments with these guys, but I was just wondering along those lines and how they keep the ball so symmetric. I mean, that's another thing that gets me. I mean, they're all Greeks in there or something, boy. Well, I'll hop off. I just appreciate it. And I want to, tell you that last issue of Wings has some beautiful photography.
Oh, yes. A wonderful publication. That's the magazine that is put out by the Xerxes Society for the Preservation of Endangered Invertebrates.
Yeah, I would like for you to throw that in.
Yeah. Hesitate to plug a Friends of Insects. And as for how that ball maintains its cohesion, It's known at least that locust swarms maintain their cohesion because, in general, locusts have a tendency when they get to the edge of a mass to turn back inwards. So that sort of maintains the margins.
That's an interesting feedback system,
Yeah, so that might apply as well to chironomid swarms.
Okay, well, thanks a lot.
All right,
thank you.
And, of course, anybody who, whether we is interested in finding out about the activities of the Natural History Survey, they do indeed have a website, which is www.INHS for Illinois Natural History Survey, INHS.UIUC.EDU. And you'll go there and you can find all about them and the research that they do, and also that there is a section here where you can click on publications and you can find out all about the things that they have available, including, I'm sure, the books that May talked about, the guides to the butterflies and silk moths. And I'm sure that you can order them direct from the survey that way, too. Other questions? Welcome. 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Let's talk with someone in Champaign. Line 3. Hello?
Yes. For years, I've enjoyed my ladybugs. In the last 3 years, I haven't seen any. I don't use any chemicals. Do you have any suggestions as to where they might be?
Well, the culprit people are pointing their fingers at is, in fact, one of their own kind. The multicolored Asian lady beetle is a non-native species that was brought over initially to the U.S. about 20 years ago for biological control of what are called arboreal aphids in trees like pecan aphids and the like.
Mm-hmm.
And they're brought into the southern U.S. and they really didn't do much in terms of pecan aphids or anything else and kind of kept a low profile. And then for reasons nobody's quite clear on, probably about 5 years ago, suddenly their maybe a little more longer ago, their numbers just absolutely exploded throughout much of eastern North America. And now they are considered noxious pests. These are the ladybugs that people find inside their houses or aggregating by the thousands, tens of thousands on outside walls. They bite. They smell bad. They have generally made themselves unwelcome, not only just people, but because they are so incredibly abundant and so incredibly undiscriminating about what they eat, the suspicion is wherever they've moved in, local ladybugs have declined in numbers. So they've been implicated in the interspecific competition and sort of displacing many of the native species, which are now getting increasingly more difficult to find. So, you know, there's only so many aphids in the world, and I guess if somebody comes in and eats them all, it makes life difficult for the less aggressive eaters. And these guys will eat anything that moves more slowly than they do. I mean, that's generally soft-bodied. We've found them eating monarch caterpillars. They'll eat just about anything. So at least in the ladybug community, or the community of ladybug scholars, there's a suspicion that one factor that may be leading to local declines in population size are these multicolored Asian lady beetles.
Any possibility that I might be able to purchase a batch of the beautiful orange ones and put them back in my yard?
Actually, a number of companies sell ladybugs for biological control. It's kind of a tricky business because, among other things, often these companies will collect ladybugs in their hibernation sites, their overwintering sites out in the West. Some of the Western species form enormous aggregations for overwintering. They sort of help to maintain their temperatures, and they are in this sort of state of suspended animation. And so it's very easy to go and shovel them up and buy the millions and put them into packages and mail them to people in Iowa and in Illinois. And the problem is when you get these ladybugs that are just emerging from hibernation, they are kind of programmed to fly west out to. And so you may very well release them and they will fly heading back for their ancestral home in California. But there are other companies that will sell species that are more locally adapted. And ironically enough, I don't know if it's ironic, the right word, but there are companies that still sell multicolored Asian ladybugs. So you can, believe it or not, spend money and order these things. And it's just insane that they're commercially available. That's an editorial aside, I guess. But yeah, so you can also infest your own home with noxious, overwintering, biting, nasty.
You. Yeah, thank you.
Sure thing. Good luck.
Bye-bye.
All right. Thanks for the call. You would think that somewhere along the line we would have learned about the problems of introduced species. As that was a case, certainly there are still introductions that happen by accident. And like the one that was the long-horned beetle that was causing so much trouble with trees and the
Asian longhorn beetle.
Asian longhorn beetle.
Yeah.
That was an accidental introduction. But the multicolored Asian lady beetle, that was introduced on purpose.
Although, in all fairness, there's a learning process. I mean, back at the turn of the 20th century, biological control was welcomed as an alternative to some incredibly nasty pesticides. I mean, people today think pesticides are dangerous, but back then, the main constituent of pesticides was arsenic and other heavy metals that, you know, people, pesticide applicators were dying from more quickly than the insects. And not much was known about specificity and timing and the like. And for example, gypsy moths were brought in, again, this was one of the more avoidable biological disasters of the 19th century. They were brought to the U.S. by an astronomer in Cambridge, Massachusetts, who decided he could breed a better silkworm, which was kind of mystifying given that gypsy moths make a silk that's not at all commercially useful. It's all very short-stranded, gray, and not, you know, doesn't. It's not like Bombyx mori, the Japanese silkworm moth, and you can't cross these species because they're in different families. And nonetheless, well, his experiment went the predictable direction, he kind of forgot about it. And gypsy moths are called gypsy moths because they have this behavior called ballooning. When they're brand new, newly hatched caterpillars, they'll spin a little tiny silken strand, which will get picked up by the wind and carry them many distances, over great distances. That's, you know, hence, like gypsies, they move, they travel. So they traveled right out of Leopold Trouvelot's garden into much of Massachusetts, and by the, you know, in short order, certainly by the turn of the 20th century, they were devastating thousands of acres of eastern forest. So this concept of biocontrol was pretty new back then, and in desperation, people brought over absolutely every natural enemy of gypsy moths from their native Europe they could find. And, I mean, that was to save the forests of the Northeast. And among the pests, the species they brought over was a little parasitic fly called Compsolora that lays its eggs inside the body of gypsy moth caterpillars. And people thought this was great. And they knew at the time that, that Compsolora fed on many more species than just gypsy moth. In fact, you know, hundreds of other lepidopterans, at least 100 other lepidopterans. But at the time, it was thought to be a good thing, because that way, gypsy moths only had one generation a year. You didn't want to lose the biocontrol agent. The fact that they had multiple hosts meant it could be sustained within the environment. Well, years later, decades later, it's thought that Compsolora concinata, this parasitic fly, might be responsible for a decline in the numbers of the giant silk moths, the Cecropia, Luna moths, Polyphemus moths, because not only do they like gypsy moths, they like these guys. And there are heavy parasite loads of some of the of these Saturnian moths. But at the time, it that was the state of the art. The really, I would say, you could say it's an accident that Asian longhorn beetles are here. But in a way, it's sort of economic expediency. The they came over, or thought to have come over, in what's called solid wood packing material, and that's just like pallets and packing and the like from China. And what solid wood packing material is made from low quality wood, which is often wood that's infested with boring beetles and not treated. So this, again, it was an economic thing. It was cheap, and it was known to be a risk factor. Really, nobody wanted to spend the money to treat the wood so that there wouldn't be live insects being transported. Something called dunnage is just wood, just hunks of trees put into holds of ships or aircraft or the like to keep things from rattling around. And again, simple matter to treat it, but it costs some money and it reduces profits. So yes, there are accidents, but I mean, pointing fingers is a dangerous business, because it can come right back and point at you, I guess. So.
Well, I guess that would be a case where you'd say that that was an unintentional introduction, but that it was it was
totally avoidable. Yes,
it didn't have to happen.
Yeah, yeah. And there are all kinds of the rules are very odd. There's a controversy now about. I don't know if anyone has heard of this practice of releasing butterflies at weddings.
Oh, mm-hmm.
And mm-hmm. For business people who sell butterflies for weddings, there are different laws than for, say, scientists who study butterflies. And if I, as a butterfly researcher, I want to bring in monarch butterflies from California, I have to file permits and paperwork and the like. But people who sell butterflies for weddings have a whole different set of requirements. And some people in the monarch community are very worried, because monarchs, different populations of monarchs follow different migratory routes to their overwintering sites in the mountains of Mexico. And there's some concern if you keep shipping these populations around that they'll get lost on their way home, and they'll interbreed with local populations, and nobody really understands how they orient anyway. So there are all kinds of peculiar rules. Stop me if you've heard this before, but we're importing honeybees from Australia. First time since 1922, the U.S. passed in 1922 an act of Congress called the Honeybee Act to restrict the importation of honeybees from other countries. And the reason for this is that at the time, England was in the throes of what was called Isle of Wight disease, an infectious disease of unknown origin, most likely caused by parasitic mites, we think now. And the idea was to protect American honeybees from disease risk by keeping other bees out. So for a long time, you could not bring other bees in. And despite this, our honeybees were, in the 80s, ended up acquiring an invasive non-native pest called the varroa mite, which has caused massive loss of honeybee colonies all over the country. There, now it's very, people may notice, it's very hard to see wild honeybees, bees that aren't kept by somebody, because the local population, feral populations have been wiped out by varroa. But you'd think now would be a more important time than ever to protect honeybees, yet there was legislation passed to allow importation from Australia because our honeybee populations are so low that particularly almond growers in California don't have enough to pollinate their trees. Almonds are very popular now. You may have noticed Snickers for the first time. When I was growing up, Snickers had peanuts. Now you can get Snickers with almonds. You can get all kinds of wonderful products with almonds, great healthy food, big demand for them. Almond production is entirely dependent on honeybees. You cannot grow almonds unless you have honeybees to pollinate them. And there just simply weren't enough U.S. honeybees to meet the demand. So there were business pressures that led to the change in the law. So who knows what we're going to bring in from Australia, although Australia's keeping pretty hoping to keep free from parasites.
Well, and of course, the honeybee that we had before was not a native species. It was introduced from
Europe
to begin with. So maybe, what do you think, that the Australian honeybee will replace the European honeybee as the one that we is that's predominant here and the one that we use for honey and for pollination?
Well, the Australian honeybee, it's not native to Australia either. It's the European honeybee.
Oh, it's the same one that came here.
Most likely. They're about... Well, it depends on who you talk to, but over a dozen different races of honeybees. So the dreaded African bee is actually just another subspecies of honeybee. Mm. That's another problem that beekeepers are having in this country. But so the different races are differentially susceptible to varroa mites. And so it's the honeybee of commerce that's coming in from Australia is probably the same race that we have here. The big problem is whether or not it's going to bring anything in. We bring in bumblebees for greenhouse pollination of tomatoes, and there's some worries that some of these, it's called bombiculture, the maintenance of bumblebees for pollination purposes, bring in foreign pathogens to infect native bumblebee populations. So it's a global world out there. I mean, there's avian flu, there's bumblebee flu too, essentially. So we're all in this big gamish of global infection and disease.
Gamish. Well, I'm verklempt now that you mentioned that. Well, we're going to have to stop, I'm sorry to say, for the moment, because we've used our time. But I'll bet a little bit later on in the summer, May, we'll come back and we'll talk some more.
Just try to stop me.
All right. Thank you very much. May Barenbaum is professor and head of the Department of Entomology at the University of Illinois. And every once in a while is here and we talk about insects. We have now a couple of minutes before we hand off to the Afternoon Magazine staff to, again, encourage people to support this program and the others that they enjoy on the station. The number to call is 244-9455. Standing by at Pledge Central is our director of corporate support. His name is Les Schulte. You've heard him before, folks, and here you're going to hear him again.
Is he still there? What's he doing out there? Anyway, we have one book left. We have the Buzzwords book from May Barenbaum's book, and she will sign that book for you. One's gone, one to go. Two more T-shirts to get out of here. The 1998 Insect Fear Film Festival T-shirts for work children. They're in size medium. And so call right now, 217-244-9455. We want to thank Jerry DeWitt from Champaign and Beth Stafford. And we've heard from Wally Morris from Carlock and Jerry Carden and Tim Temple from Urbana. Thank you very much for your support. This is the last opportunity for you during this drive to support Focus 580. And if you really do value this program, it's a unique show, and it needs your support right now. You know what, David? Mm-hmm. The next $15 is going to put us over the $85,000 mark
great.
Towards our goal of $95,000 for today. And to do that, we have a couple of other incentives. Stuart Levy, a good friend of this station who appreciates the this valuable service, is going to add $10 to every pledge, up to 90 pledges. He's been doing that. And then just recently, John Traynor from Traynor Grain in Forest, Illinois, he says, you know what, I'll add $10 to every pledge for AM 580 today, too. So that's $20 onto your pledge right now at 217-244-9455 to support Focus 580 and all of the programs you enjoy here on WILL. You can put that pledge on your credit card. We do accept Visa, MasterCard, Discover, and American Express. 217-244-9455. Are the books gone? I think the books...
The books are
gone.
Okay, but we still have a couple of the T-shirts.
I think I'm kind of losing track out here.
I'm telling you, these are really cool now.
They really are.
We'll score great points.
Yeah,
there are kids who have cockroaches calling all over the teachers. They're going to say, "Mom, Dad, this is the coolest ever." So I'm telling you, for a $40 pledge, you could have one of these shirts. And we only have a couple of them.
They're still T-shirts. Okay,
still T-shirts. Still two of them.
Two T-shirts left. Books are gone. Right.
The books are gone.
All right.
So May will sign those. We do have the T-shirts, and just folks, we're always looking for something to get you jazzed, to go to the phone, something that will persuade you to make that call. And it is really important, as we've said here, a big chunk of the budget comes from listeners.
It is. Over 40% of the budget comes from listeners, and that makes us listener-supported radio, is what we talk about.
And we really actually like that. We'd rather be listener-supported than government-supported, believe me.
Yeah, how about, do you want to be government-supported radio?
I don't like the sound.
I don't like the sound of that either. I do like listener-supported radio. Has a great ring to it. And because of listener support, folks like Stuart Levy, who will add $10 to your pledge right now, the folks at Traynor Grain in Forest, Illinois, they're adding $10 to your contribution right now. That's an extra $20 onto your pledge right now for AM 580 at 217-244-9455. Call right now and make that contribution.
All right. Thank you very much, Les. We want to keep the phone ringing here as we proceed into the afternoon. And we hand things off to the Afternoon Magazine, Celeste Quinn, as the host for the show. And just in a moment here, we got to flip some switches. And there we go. There she is. Hi.
Hi. How about that?
Take it away.
It's magic. This is...